Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. You got a question, comment, thought, something you want to jump in on real quick. 866-416-RICK. 866-416-7425. Sorry, Spicy. Sean Spicer wanted to get his political patronage gig back. But a federal judge denied his attempt and that of Russ Voigt to be returned to the board of the U.S. Naval Academy. You may remember back a little while ago, Spicy, Voigt, Kellyanne Conway, a number of other folks Biden removed from the Academy boards and replaced them with people that he thought were better suited. Kellyanne Conway, no idea why she would be on the Air Force Academy board, other than, hey, it's a paycheck. They removed them, sent them packing, and like I said, a federal judge said, no, sorry, Spicy. So no gig for Spicy. There you go. Interesting couple of little tidbits today on the virus and the vaccine. Evidently, since May of this year, people living in the counties that voted for Trump, that voted heavily for Trump, in the last election, have been nearly three times likely to die from COVID-19 as those who were in areas that voted for President Biden. You go, well, you know, I had someone, you know, tweet to me, well, that's a good thing. No, it's not a good thing. Look, if you're unvaccinated and you get sick, that's on you. You made a choice. You get what's coming to you. If you're not going to wear the mask in public and you're going to risk being unvaccinated, hey, you rolled the dice. You lost. I'm not going to celebrate it, but it is kind of, you go, duh. It is what it is. Also, Axios reported the CDC's 7-day average for vaccinations up yesterday to 1.8 million from 1.3 a month ago. And that's telling me that maybe in some of those heavily Trump counties, they're going, maybe it's not a hoax. Maybe the Clorox ain't working. Because you're three times more likely to die than someone who voted for Biden in one of those counties. The U.S. has finally hit 60% of overall vaccination, according to the CDC, and 71.5% of folks over the age of 18 years old. That's a push in the right direction. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards also said that he plans to put the COVID vaccine on the list of required shots for K-12 students entering Louisiana schools. This should be an interesting fight. Now, didn't have a problem with the rubella and measles and mumps and chicken pox and all that other stuff that we've been doing for years and very few people have bothered complaining about. The second this, I think the whole apple cart could be upset. But we'll see where it goes. 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. If you want to jump in quick with a thought, a question, comment. Got a couple of emails that I found interesting. I got one from Nancy, I believe it is, says, I was turning the channel and caught your show. I just want to say, in my opinion, you have it all wrong. You're telling people false propaganda. Isn't that what you want? Wouldn't you want me to tell false propaganda? Wouldn't you want would you be afraid of true propaganda? She said, please stop. The uneducated will believe you and get hurt by what you say. It's a good thing that you only have 418 followers on Instagram. I forgot I had an Instagram account. So, you know, Nancy, thank you for reminding me. I didn't even know I had 418, but thank you for that. I'll have to work on that, maybe if I remember the password. But she went and goes into this whole story. You know, I was a union member all these years, 43 years, and I'll bet you she's got a pension, and I'll bet you she always had health care, and I'll bet you she always had a good wage. I'll bet you she had good, safe working conditions. I bet she had all of that stuff and took every bit of it for granted. But I digress. Her problem is there were some people who were bad eggs. They cheated on their time cards. They drank. They stole stuff. They did all kinds of bad stuff. And you go, that's horrible. And the company should have done something about that. It's their job to manage their employees. The union doesn't get to tell the company how to do its business. It doesn't. It just says that there's a parameter in how you have to deal with things. You have to have due process. So, Nancy, I don't know what world you came out of, but the union doesn't tell the company how to operate. There's a contract in place. There are rules and procedures just like anything else. And if the company chooses not to follow them, that's on them. This idea, you can never fire a union member. Yes, you can. You just have to do it the right way. You have to go through a process. This idea that I can fire you for any reason or no reason at all is something that every American worker should be dead set against. You should be fired for just cause, which is what happens in a union environment. If you do something wrong, you screw something up, you do a bad job, you don't come to work, the company disciplines you and moves through a process towards discharge. That happens. It happens often. But you get people like this who keep throwing out these talking points. And I got to tell you, I doubt she was ever in a union. But, you know, it's good to have talking points. It's good to hit those points thrown out by the anti-union folks. She said, this is the one I love. The union was good back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, etc. You mean when they were doing sit-down strikes and they were literally, you know, blowing things up? Is that what you mean, Nancy? Okay. She said, when people couldn't speak for themselves, but now they're no longer needed. She said, also, caveat, I am a Democrat and regret voting for Biden. He's destroying our country and putting us all in danger. Okay. And I get these all the time. This is clearly a Republican troll just wanting to, hey, you know, I'm gonna make you respond to this. So I responded. And look, these people I want to reach out to and have a dialogue with. Because if she truly was a union member, there are things that are wrong here that need to be addressed. And as I've said, you know, the company, that's their problem. But when I went to email her back, oddly enough, it bounced back to me. Because this, again, is one of those who knows who they are, where they are, here or anywhere else. There were a lot of common misspellings and stuff like that. It makes me go, I don't even know if she's a U.S. citizen or even in this country. That's a problem. So, Nancy, if you're listening and you sent this email, please email me again with one that I can respond to. Also, I got another one from Mr. No Name. Again, fictitious email that bounced back when I tried to respond. But I love these, and I had to address this one because, again, it's another one of those moments. Rick, I'm tired of you Democrats whining about the wealthy. Love these. Because they're these folks, and I know them. I actually know people who they ascribe to the Horatio Alger, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You could be a self-made billionaire, too, and a handful of people will be. The vast majority of folks, not going to. Which means that they shouldn't be exploited and shouldn't work their entire lives for poverty wages. But I digress. Mr. No Name writes, the game is not rigged. You're just lazy workers who need to get an education and work hard. Again, the Horatio Alger thing. Maybe someday you'll have wealth you want protected from handouts to the lazy and welfare people shaving too many kids. I'm guessing that was having. Again, a lot of these talking points. Getting a college degree, I don't know if you've noticed, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get to the middle class. What it does mean, and we've talked about this on the program, means you're probably going to be saddled with a lifetime of student loan debt. which means you're probably going to get fleeced by predatory student loan companies who are going to line their pockets with your future earnings. But again, never mind the reality of the situation. It's easier to say you just got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You should work hard because you too could be in that 1%. And the reality is no, chances are it's never going to happen. And not even if you win the lottery usually. Because I look at this report done, the World Inequality Report, reported on by the BBC, that said 2020 saw the steepest increase in billionaire wealth on record. Now, you come here to the U.S., our 745 USDA-certified billionaire class, they saw their wealth grow by, what was about $2.5 trillion from the beginning of the pandemic. They point out that while 100 million people sunk into extreme poverty, the top 10 wealthiest people on the planet now take 52% of global income. So just 10%. And I would argue that half of, 1%, the top 1% takes the majority of that even. They point out that the poorest half, the bottom 50% of us, just 8%. And you go, there's massive inequality, not just here in the U.S., but across the globe. And when you start talking about policy that's going to go, hey, we need to figure out how to do this. And we did this after World War II. This is part of what countries did around the world to kind of stave off, the growth of a wealth class to, put us back where we are right now, where whatever they want, they get. We had very high tax rates on wealth because we didn't want to have someone so powerful that they could buy, Congress, that they could buy, a seat in Congress or a governor's mansion or whatever. And that's happened in our past. And we've always said that's a bad thing. But you look at this and, it's not just the globe. It's here at home as well. The numbers are staggering. And this idea, and look, I mentally love the idea that, hey, if you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead. I wish that were true for the vast majority of people. And, hard work does get you a little bit, I think, ahead. Never going to get you into the 1% or the 10%. It's just not. Luck comes into this, invisible capital that most of us don't even realize that we have. Yeah, I had a friend who, he loves to throw out the fact that he's doing really well. Owns his own business, doing great. His parents gave him the money to start the business, allowed him to stay in their house for like 10 years while he was building the business. His father's business was something that he was able to slave off of. So when the father's business would have an event, he was there to record it. When the father's business did something, he was there to provide a service for it. So there was some ready-made business. And it's that invisible capital that, just not anybody can just up and start an audiovisual company and do the kind of things that he does without having that invisible capital. Stuff that most people don't even think of. Again, it's the bootstraps. It's easy to pull yourself up by your bootstraps when you have them. This is a scenario where we got a lot of people on this planet who, they're no bootstraps. And that's where policy comes in. And nobody's saying we're going to make rich people poor. You go back to John Rockefeller, richest man in the world back when he passed away, it's got to be 100 years ago. When he was taxed in the estate tax, he was taxed at 70%. 70% of his estate was taxed through the estate tax. And yet, oddly enough, there are still rich Rockefellers today. Imagine that. But we're told, especially by the rich, that if we tax them, they're not going to be able to do all the wonderful things that they were doing in the past. They won't be able to create all the jobs that they create. And the sad reality is they're not doing it now. This is the part that's infuriating to me. We were sold this bill of goods. We were sold this bill of goods that if we give the wealthy in corporate America all of the advantages, give them all the money, give them all the control, privatize everything. Nothing in the hands of we the people. Nothing in the hands of us. There's no such thing as the commons. No such thing as the public good. Everything in the hands of the profiteers. That's going to be better. They're going to be able to use the money more efficiently. We're going to get more services and better services because they're going to weed out the inefficiencies and they're going to do it in a much better way. And you find out that's not even remotely close to the truth, especially as they skim off a huge portion of it to pay themselves and their shareholders and themselves and their shareholders. And oh yeah, themselves and their shareholders. The products now seem secondary. The services, secondary. The main goal of corporate America now, especially when you're looking at big corporate America, is feeding the monster, feeding Wall Street, feeding the investor class, making sure the shareholders are well taken care of. Because remember, the Business Roundtable, you know, for years they were pitching, you know, their main goal is maximizing shareholder wealth, of which, interestingly enough, about a year and a half ago, or maybe it was 2 years ago, they came out and said, no, we now care about our customers and our maybe our workers and somewhat the community. Have you seen things change? The answer is no. That was all PR and spin. And you know it was, because we're finally waking up to the reality. The reality? We're getting screwed, man. Every time we turn around, someone is in our pocket for things that two generations ago were part of the commons. And now there's a thirst, there's a want to reclaim the public good, to reclaim the public space, and to do it in a way that benefits we the people, that benefits the working class of this country. There's now an interest, and now we care. And what we have to do is we have to take this momentum and make it policy, which is why I like Biden's Build Back Better plan. Could it be better? Absolutely. There's never been a policy that's been put into law that I think is perfect. There are no perfect laws. There are ones that are beneficial that we can use and always want to tweak to make better. But the Build Back Better plan gets us in a direction where we're investing in the future of this country, where we're helping the working poor, where we're helping single mothers like my mother to make sure that they're able to take care of their kids and give them an opportunity, the kind of things that I didn't have, the kind of things that my mother didn't have. This is an opportunity to make this a better place to live. The kind of place that we talk about it being. There's an opportunity to reset 40 years of bad trade policy, of bad economic policy, of bad tax policy, of bad public policy. There is an opportunity to do the right things. And we do it in a way that the people who have benefited the most, our gazillionaire class, that they're the ones, sorry, they're going to have to foot some of the bill. And we use those resources in a positive way to move us all forward. Makes sense to me. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1896. That was the day 11 steam engineers met in Chicago to found the National Union of Steam Engineers, the forerunner to the International Union of Operating Engineers. 10 of the 11 came from the stationary field. They often worked 60 to 90 hours a week in dangerous working conditions. Constructing and operating steam boilers was highly skilled, labor-intensive, and potentially dangerous work. At the time, boilers were used for steam-powered railroad and construction shovels, hoists and cranes for high-rise construction, and electric power generation. Many flocked to San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake to help rebuild that city. Others left for Panama to work on the canal. By 1912, the union was issuing charters to locals that represented construction steam engineers and locals that represented fixed boiler operators. It was renamed the International Union of Operating Engineers in 1928. During World War II and after, thousands worked
ranked as Navy Seabees, building military bases, airfields, and roads. The Federal Highway Trust Program opened up work for thousands more in the construction of the nation's highway system. Today, you can find operating engineers on bridges and dam projects, skyscrapers, and pipelines. Its logo, the steam gauge, was originally set at 80 PSI, but now points towards 420 PSI. Some think the change came as a result of operating high-pressure boilers for naval ships and steamboats. Others speculate the change came when the 600 PSI gauge became the industrial standard. The Industrial Union of Operating Engineers administers 100 apprenticeships in state-of-the-art facilities, requiring 6,000 hours of on-the-job training and 400 hours classroom instruction. It represents more than 400,000 members in 170 locals throughout the United States and Canada.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So interesting. We talked about a couple of days ago how there was a tentative agreement with the BTCGM union, the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco, and Grain Millers Union, and Kellogg's. And I said, I'm not sure that this is enough. I was talking about, the main issue was the two-tier wage system, and it didn't look like it closed it enough for me. And I wasn't sure. I was not surprised, however, when it was overwhelmingly rejected. And now the story is going like this. And I'll tell you, I think this is, part of me goes, this is the setup. But Kellogg has announced that they're going to start permanently replacing the striking workers, which this is where I'm hoping, having a new general counsel at the National Labor Relations Board, I'm hoping this becomes that moment where we go back and overturn this kind of behavior, where companies are looking to replace their employees. But here to share some thoughts on, well, why they voted down the contract, the tentative agreement, and where they go from here, I've asked Todd Manousos to come and talk with us. Todd is a striking BCTGM worker there in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Todd, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, absolutely. But we're in Battle Creek, Michigan.
Oh, screwed that up. Battle Creek. And how can I screw that up? That's one of those things. It's one of those things I knew. Let's start with the vote. I was not surprised that the vote went down, given what was put out in the news stories. Why do you think the vote went the way it went?
Well, like you just hit the nail right on the head. I mean, the why we went on strike hasn't been addressed. I haven't been out on the strike line all this time to come back for this type of contract. It really didn't, so far as the transitionals path to full time could take excess of 9 years, and the it was just plain garbage. It was movement a little bit where they came off some of their other ridiculous have-to-haves. But in the grand scheme of things, when we're really looking at like the red and beaten potatoes of this thing, it's garbage.
So hold on. I'm going to go back to this for a second, because 9 years to get to the full rate. 9 years?
It could theoretically take some employees over 9 years to get to it. So while they like to boast within the media, it's yes, we've created a path, or we've kept the path. They made the path, theoretically a million miles long. You can't even see the light at the end of the tunnel for that for some people. It's not a realistic time frame for someone to start at a place of employment and then graduate to full time.
And, as we've talked about when we've been talking about this for the last several weeks, because you guys have been on strike, 9 weeks now?
Probably more.
Yeah, the last 9 weeks we've been talking about this, and you go, how is it that you can have a workplace where there is such a massive gap between the folks who are making top rate and the folks who've been there a couple of years and making so much less with worse benefits and worse retirement security? How do you keep that workplace together, especially in a union environment? I would argue that is put in place specifically to divide and conquer you guys.
Oh, absolutely. They want have and have nots. My path to there, my dad worked there for 34 years. He got me there as a summer help program. So that's how I started my career at Kellogg's. I've been there for 24 years now. I've been kind of in the shoes of the newer people, not getting the same rate, not getting the same protection, but it was all under the guise that that would go away. You know, and I've had people like my dad, people that were friends with my dad and stuff like that, protect me, look after me and things like that. So who am I if I don't look at the next generation, even if my kids want to work there, my stepdaughter worked there this summer, who am I to step on their rights to the same things that were fought for me?
Now how big of a difference are we talking about when, you know, when people say, well, you know, I had someone, you know, contact me not too long ago. Well, where I work, it takes 4 years to get the top rate. And, you know, that's just the dues you have to pay. You don't get to start off at the top. And nobody's talking about starting off at the top. But at least, you know, as you said, they've made the journey a million miles long. How long are we talking about? What's the difference? Are we talking, you know, 20%, 40%? Where do you put that number at?
You know, that's a really good question. For them, they want to say 3% right off the bat. And then for each year after that, they'll hire maybe a handful. And and at that point, if you've been there for 7 years and they've reached their percentage, maybe good luck next year. That to us, that's not reasonable. That's not acceptable, and that's not why we went out on strike.
Yeah. No, it wasn't about the wages. It wasn't about that. It was about closing that gap.
For me, I'm not asking for a pay raise. I would be happy if the contract stayed the way it is with my COLA, my benefits, and the current wage the way it is. I'm not going out on the street for more money, but I'll be damned if I'm going back in the building without, you know, taking care of my family that works there.
Now, Kellogg today came out, and the story, as I saw it today, is that they're talking about permanent replacements. It's interesting timing, given the fact that the NLRB General Counsel Jennifer Abruzzo just came out and said that they may have to look at this replacement doctrine. I'm looking at this moment going, I wonder if what has happened was on purpose. This is what Kellogg's has wanted, a way to get rid of the union and be able to just throw you guys out the door, or if this is just opportunism. I'm curious where you put things.
I think when I look at this and their actions and their words today, you know, they've been trying to replace us since the moment we walked out on the street with AFIMAC, with different, you know, outside consulting people coming in. The fact of the matter is they don't know what they're doing. This doesn't necessarily scare us. From my understanding, from a union president, we have several filings in there. With six, we only need one to stick, and this all goes away. So we're standing behind our negotiating and our legal team. On the other side of things, we're looking at optics now, right? We're going to find someone to replace you. You know, it sounds like a scary term, but when we look at the plans across the board, they're running like absolute garbage. The only thing that they're feeding in there is cows, chickens, and pigs. They're running an entire amount of feed. They're frustrated each and every single day. Their thing is they have to work 7 days. Their salary has to work 7 days in a row, 7/12s. They get a day off, and then they're back in for 7/12s. They're beat up. You know, they don't have the heart for this. They're not conditioned for this, and they're ready to crack more than anybody that's ready to crack. So when we hear things like that in the, you know, them saying that, that's just typical scare tactic. We're going to find someone to do your job. If that was true during these 10 plus weeks we've been out on strike, they would have been running. They would have found some place to replace us. This isn't all of a sudden they're like, okay, well, now we're serious about trying to run food here. They've been trying to run food without us since the start of it, and they're failing across the board. They're having a high turnover rate. You know, people are quitting on the salary side left and right. I know for a fact the people that are in there, they're not going to be there after the first of the year because they're looking for different jobs. This is not what they signed up for.
Yeah, no, I'm sure a lot of the management people can't wait for you to come back because, as you said, it's actual work and it takes some skill to do. But I found the spokesperson's response pretty interesting. He said, interest in the permanent replacement roles has been strong at all four plants. As expected, we expect some new hires to start very soon. And I'm going, you've got that many scabs willing to cross a picket line to take a job that, well, they probably aren't going to be around in for very much longer. I don't know that I share your optimism.
Yeah, for what they're paying and what you can find in a different place around here through typical shift work, And then that, again, plays into our benefit. I was a substitute teacher today, so when I got the news, I had to kind of keep it to a dull roar excited. But the different jobs that you can find out there for now, Kellogg's what they're trying to trap people in with. It's not worth it for the time that you'll have to give up. And those that are coming aren't staying. So even if somebody does come in and they start to get a hold, you're not going to hold on to that person. That person's going to leave because right. Nobody wants to do 7-12s for the rest of their, foreseeable future.
Right. And this is one of the things, Todd, that has come up with other folks that I've talked to, the amount of overtime that's there because they can't keep people. So they're kind of abusing the overtime. I don't know if that's your experience, but because Absolutely. They can't keep people because they've created this bizarre environment, which is kind of a self-fulfilling disaster zone. Where people aren't staying, which means we're going to have to abuse the people who are, which would cost them, I think, more in the long run. It just seems like a bad idea from the start and something that you would expect in 2019, not in 2021, given the fact that you guys worked through a pandemic, that we were calling you heroes and frontline heroes and essential, and you were patriotic for feeding America, to now come and do this. I think they're living a couple years ago at the bargaining table.
Yeah, that's the nail right on the head. I mean, when you look at this just seems like an old playbook. They just want to keep on saying, oh, woe is us, our business. And, for rewind the clocks 18 months ago, we were heroes, right? The CEO called us such in the meetings. I still have a note in my car from the plant manager to hand to Michigan State Police if I get pulled over during a curfew time because I'm an essential worker. I have to be there. And what a quiet pride it was for us to be able to feed our community, feed our, state, feed our country, and answer that call. And then the other side of things, when we're negotiating the contract, it's a simple ask. Just pay us the same. The people that have been your backbone and have given you these profits, record profits, it's nothing. At our plant specifically, we're talking less than probably 40 people that are the transitionals, that they say that this is not sustainable. And when we look at all the money that they're spending on, bringing temporary workers in and feeding them, clothing them, housing them, transporting them, training them and having the high turnover rate, it's not a question of money for them. It's just who they're putting into. And honestly, it's a huge, huge slap in our face and this huge show of disrespect for the way that we've done, the way that we provided for that company.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Todd Manosis. He's a striking BCTGM member in Battle Creek, Michigan. And I got that one right this time. Again, this is one of those moments where I look at this, Todd. If you got a question for Todd, I'd love to hear it. 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. I look at some of the bargaining that's gone on, and one of the things that I thought was kind of a slap in the face as well. I'm a union label guy. When I go to the supermarket, I'm turning over the bread. I'm turning over the snacks. I'm turning over stuff. I'm looking for that label. And BCTGM does it better than just about anybody, where I know if this bread or this cereal or this anything is union made, I'm going to buy it. I walked into a store, and the first time in my life I've looked at the Raisin Bran, and there was no union label on it. And I know at the bargaining table they were requesting to stop putting that on there, which I think would be a huge mistake, and it would make me angry. Is that a slap in the face too?
Oh, it's absolutely a slap in the face. I mean, they want to take away kind of – and. Let's be clear. We're the ones that make one of the best products in the world, despite management. We're the ones that go in, like I talked about, I'm a second generation. People are fourth generation. Other people there, they're the first start of it. It's in your DNA. You care about your products because it's world renowned and we do it. It was interesting in the negotiations. They said, well, can we make the label smaller? No. And so in the last talks they've had, they finally abandoning asking for that whatsoever, and they consider that a concession to stop talking about taking our label off the good products that we produce. And in a lot of ways we look at that as a safety thing. Memphis got locked out in 2013, they had a gentleman relieve himself on the cornflakes belt, make a YouTube video of it, and then post it after that product got to consumers. So, I mean, this is the same Affomac company that they're employing to bring people in now and to take care of our products. When we get asked the question all the time, you know, what is your biggest fear on the line? You know, are you afraid that they're going to get up and running and, you know, you'll be out? No, that's not what we're afraid. We're afraid they're going to wreck our product that we've spent generations building up on a good name. And like I'm glad you brought it up, that bug, that symbol on there, is it okay to anybody that looks at this thing? It's like, yes, this is a fresh, well-made food that you could give to your family.
No, that is an excellent point. And it's not something I've thought of before, that you're protecting their brand better than they are, that you have more stake in the game than the company does. And look, I look at your CEO who makes tons of money. The shareholders are fat and happy. It makes no sense to share that wealth where we're told if we give the companies all the wealth that eventually it'll trickle down. Doesn't seem to be trickling.
No, it doesn't.
So last question I've got for you, and you know, this is the big one, because I think all of us have a vested interest in you guys getting the best contract you can get so you can get back to work making the products that we all enjoy. What can we do to help? How do we move this forward?
I think, you know, from the start, you know, when we went out did day one, you know, people driving by and just showing support, whether they're honking a horn or people have stopped by the line, you know, hey, I didn't have a ton of money, but here's 8 coffees for you guys, or I was able to bring on hand warmers or whatever. People's comments, you know, if you go to Kellogg.com or I'm sorry, their Facebook post, Kellogg's Facebook, people are letting them absolutely have it, and we love it. They think that it's just a few people that are upset and a few noisemakers. They're not feeling the full weight of the people, and just, you know, you don't have to be necessarily a pro-union person to hear our plight and, you know, want an equality for everybody and not get behind that. I mean, this isn't like a red or a blue issue. This kind of transcends that. So I think anybody that can say anything on social media and, you know, kind of get behind us and support us in these quiet conversations, you know, within an office or, you know, things like that, that's what's making the difference. Yeah. They're shocked right now. They're shocked because they try to negotiate with us through mailing us at home, you know, trying scare tactics, and they thought it would work, and they absolutely believed we were going to vote unanimously for this, yes, and they are reeling right now. And again, the only way we're able to do that, I have an amazing wife, an amazing family that are supporting me at home, but when I leave this home, I feel supported, and that's so huge when you're out there fighting these fights, to feel like you're not alone.
It's good stuff. Todd, I appreciate you taking a little time for us. Best of luck. One day longer, one day stronger. And I hope you'll come back and when this is over and tell us how things have gone.
Yes. Thank you for having me. Anytime.
Good stuff, Todd. Thanks so much. Again, you know, this is why what I've been saying, this adopt a striker idea, get to a picket line, help these folks out. You know, adopt a striker, walk with them, listen to them. And look, if you can throw in a couple of bucks and help, we'll get a link out on how you can support the GoFundMe page so that they're able to get through the holidays. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day that troops from the 22nd Infantry arrived in Goldfield, Nevada, on the orders from President Teddy Roosevelt. 1,900 gold miners organized by the Western Federation of Miners were on strike. They walked out in late November when cash-strapped mine operators began paying them in scrip. Local 77 held considerable power in the mines and the town for 2 years. They had won the 8-hour day both for their members and established it as an industrial standard throughout Goldfield. By 1907, the mine operators and Nevada Governor John T. Sparks had had enough.
Wobblies were on trial elsewhere, falsely accused of murdering Idaho Governor Frank Stoltenberg for his role in the 1899 miner strike in Coeur d'Alene. Many miners in Goldfield had been active in that strike. Sparks feared that with no force capable of protecting the operators, another mine war was inevitable. The mine owners convinced Sparks that the miners were heavily armed and capable of dynamiting mine property. At the same time, the operators tried to provoke local 77 miners to engage in illegal activities for which they could be arrested. They also used the financial panic of 1907 to pay workers in scrip and as a pretext to smash the union, even though the gold standard remained relatively stable. The owners then made their moves. They reduced wages and threatened workers with mass firings and strike breakers. But the union remained disciplined and peaceful during the strike. It was clear by the following March that the presence of federal troops gave the mine owners the impetus they needed to drive local 77 miners out of the mines and out of Goldfield.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So one of the big challenges of the next probably 10 years is how are you going to organize the behemoth of Amazon? How are you going to make those good family-sustaining wage jobs? How are you going to turn those into the future jobs that we need? And I look at New York, where you would think it would almost be a no-brainer. With the culture of unionism in New York to organize Amazon and the problems they've been having. There was supposed to be a vote. They pulled some of that back because, look, at the end of the day, what we do know is Amazon will not leave any stone unturned. They will spend everything they can possibly do to deny workers their ability to join and form a union. Just look at the stuff they pulled in Alabama. But I saw this tweet that went out by the Amazon Labor Union, the folks there in New York, that said, yet they've filed another unfair labor practice with the NLRB against Amazon. They say this time the company forces its employees to attend anti-union captive audience meetings and lies about their statutory rights, which is coercive and violates the NLRA. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what exactly is Amazon doing and why it's against the law. I've asked Seth Goldstein to talk with us. Seth is a pro bono attorney for the Amazon Labor Union. Seth, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So walk me through this, this charge that Amazon is violating the law by having these captive audience meetings, which they've done, you know, all across in every place where they've been, where companies have been doing these things for as long as I can remember. Why now is this an unfair labor charge?
Well, Amazon has been violating the law all along. A matter of fact, their flyers and that they post in the bathrooms and throughout the company basically say to the employees that if you sign what's called a union showing of interest card, then you would lose your rights to have the right to meet with your manager, or the alternative that immediately dues would come out of your paycheck. Both are against the National Labor Relations Act. Both of them are against federal labor law. Yet Amazon continues to lie to those employees about their rights. And we submit that the lie, the untruth, creates an inherent coercion. And the lie then went into the captive audience meetings. A matter of fact, Amazon workers in New York have been taping the meetings. They've been fighting back at the meetings. And in the meetings, the employer says the same things that they say on the flyers. So again, we're going to the National Labor Relations Act and saying, you cannot lie to employees, just like you can't lie to them about OSHA. You can't lie to employees about wage and hour or ERISA or Social Security. So that type of deception is illegal, and we expect the NLRB to move on it.
And, you know, but this is one of those things where, you know, over the years, people have believed that, you know, it's just the employer, you know, telling their side of the story. So it's not a lie. They're just telling how they see things. How would you respond to that?
No, they're lying about it, because what they're saying is that a right that's in the National Labor Relations Act doesn't apply to the employees. So it's not just puffery. It's just not talking of, you know, exaggerating. It's a very specific lie that creates a fear in the employees and therefore is coercive.
Right. So now this is something that has been going on for a while, and it goes back to this TriCast doctrine, which, I remember during the Obama years, they were talking about undoing, because this decision, this doctrine, if you will, gives wide latitude to what companies can say. What would changing this mean for these captive audience meetings? And can you explain first what it is?
Well, in 1985, the NLRB ruled with the Reagan board that an employer could basically lie to their employees about anything under federal labor law. And that was not the case prior to 1985. So during the Reagan board, there were a series of anti-worker decisions that were not challenged during the Clinton years, nor during the Obama years. And so thankfully, this general counsel has been soliciting from attorneys and from unions charges that she feels that she can bring in front of the board to overturn bad anti-worker decisions. Now, I believe that if we can overturn TRICAM and decisions like that, we can remake the National Labor Relations Act. We can do what the PRO Act is supposed to do legislatively, administratively. So overturning TRICAM would make the employer have to be honest with the employees, because there's Supreme Court case law that says that when an employer holds a captive audience meeting, they have to speak to objective fact. Lying about your statutory rights is a lie. It's fake.
Well, it's the same thing that, you know, they say that policemen can lie in interrogations. I've always thought it's the same kind of thing. If you buy it, that's on you. But this is where the union should be doing some inoculation and education. But you're just saying they shouldn't be able to lie at all. They've got to stick to the facts.
Well, how can we expect them to put up posters and, you know, settle cases with the National Labor Relations Board if they lie about people's rights when they have captive audience meetings?
No, I'm of the mindset that we should be banning these captive audience meetings as a whole.
Well, I think that that's what this is going to lead to, because I think that the board will take the next step, and I'm hoping that they would, that any captive audience meeting is inherently coercive. But if we can overrule the TRICAM decision, and there's a decision prior to that in 1982 called the Miller decision, we'll have gone a long way of empowering workers to call out an employer when they do lie during a meeting.
As we were talking about, in this, several weeks in the past, you look at what happened to Amazon in Bessemer, Alabama, and it's a lot of the things that we're talking about. There were a lot of the misinformation being thrown out, a lot of being, peppered with misinformation and plastered, billboards on doors, and having people walking around the facilities with sandwich boards and all kinds of stuff. Actually had the Postal Service put a mailbox on their property. That just blows my mind. I'm looking at the PRO Act. I'm looking at this moment going, something happens that has to happen. I just don't see it politically. If I'm getting what you're saying right, that with this National Labor Relations Board, we can undo some of the bad decisions of the past. What happens when Democrats then lose power? Wouldn't it just go right back to where it was?
Well, the TRICAM decision came to fruition in 1985. That's, over 40 years ago. So case law at the board can remain for a long time. Now, it would be better if we could pass the PRO Act or certainly the remedies provision in the Build Back Better Act. And that would help a lot too. Yeah. Imagine a situation where if an employer lies during a captive audience meeting, it's a $50,000 charge. And, you know, now workers can sit in the captive audience meetings calculating how much money this is going to cost Amazon.
And look, they're willing to spend it. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Seth Goldstein. Seth is an attorney working with the Amazon labor union. They've filed, you know, unfair labor practice charges. Going to be interesting to see. Where do you expect these to go? How do you expect this to turn out?
So there are a couple things happening. Besides the board charge on the captive audience meeting, we're pushing the NLRB to do a 10J injunctive relief case against Amazon. We think now we have close to dozens of charges against the employer. And by the way, the NLRB has found merit in many of our charges. So we believe that the administrative process doesn't work and that the NLRB should be going to federal court to enjoin Amazon. We have a couple of people that have been fired. We've had the captive audience meetings. We want them to end. And so, yeah, we're pushing the board to go to federal court immediately.
Let's go to the phone lines. Let's get Chris on line one. Chris, how are we doing tonight?
Hey, how you doing, Rick? I just called to check in. I told Seth I was going to check in. So I'm checking in with you guys. Happy to be on the show.
You got a question for Chris or for Seth?
No. You know, this is Chris Balls, the president of the Amazon Labor Union. I was just calling to check in and just share my solidarity with Seth. And everything he's saying is spot on. Seth has been doing an amazing job standing up for workers' rights. And as you mentioned, we have a slew of ULPs that we filed, and I'm hoping that we're going to be successful in our campaign. So thank you for having me, and solidarity.
Good stuff, Chris. I appreciate it. And love to have you get on the program someday soon. But, you know, Chris has done an excellent job, I think, Seth, and you know, ushering this along and bringing this along where, you know, this is one guy leading this charge. I give him credit.
Absolutely.
So last question I've got for you, you know, what can people do? What can the workers do? What can folks do to help push this along and expose some of the nonsense that's been going on?
Well, I think any support to the Staten Island group of workers is important. Remember, this is a organization that is being run by workers and there isn't any labor union involvement. Certainly, we would welcome labor union involvement because it's their fight as well. If we are successful with TRICAM and these other decisions, it should help not just Amazon unionizing efforts, but also national organizing as well. One labor attorney for management said it would turn labor relations on its head. So any support from attorneys or people that can come out to Staten Island to lend solidarity to Chris and the ALU would be really important.
Yeah, good stuff. Seth, I appreciate the time. Keep me informed on what you guys are doing, and I appreciate you taking some time for us.
Thank you.
Good stuff. No, I mean, at the end of this, this is one of those battles that are really extremely important. And I know the Teamsters are doing, they're doing something to help, do some of the organizing that's going to have to happen. I know a lot of unions are into this because Amazon, if workers can organize there, they can organize anywhere. Thanks so much, Seth. I appreciate that. And look, you know, the reason I kept asking him about, well, why can't the employers, have their side of this? He's spot on, and he smacked me with it. You got to tell the truth. You don't get to lie. You got to tell the truth. And in these moments, some of the horrible tactics that we've seen, and good on those Amazon workers there in Staten Island who have been putting things online. You get to watch some of these union busters come in and you know, the sleight of hand that they use, the tales that they tell of how, you're going to lose your rights and you won't be able to talk to the boss. Nonsense. What you do get with a union, though, is a contract. something every CEO in this country has, defines the terms of employment. This is why I'm a supporter of unions. It comes down to the contract. It's in black and white what the expectations from me to the employer are, from the employer to me. There's no guesswork. There's no favoritism. There's no, hey, I need my nephew needs a job. Sorry, you're out the door. There's none of that. Everything is in black and white. There's no guessing. And there's no changing things midstream. This is why companies don't like it. You know, they want to be able to be firmly in control, a dictatorship. And I mean, where I live in Pennsylvania, the workers' compensation law still refers to the employer-employee relationship as master and servant. It does. You can't make this up. It doesn't put you on equal grounds with the employer, but it gives you some footing and some rights. And this seems, you know, I think back to when I first started working, you know, over 30 years ago, it seemed normal that you would have the ability to have some say in the place where you spend more than a third of your life, that you would have some ability to say, you know what, I'm not going to beg for a nickel or a quarter. I'm going to demand a portion of the wealth that my labor creates. You know, and it's not surprising me that the bad decisions that came out of the 80s we're still saddled with today. It's not surprising to me that all of the things that the horrible stuff that came out of the Reagan administration to destroy unions and to destroy a tax code that was somewhat rational. You know, when Reagan took office, the top marginal tax rate was 70%, which meant the Bezoses and the Musks of the world would be paying a 70% tax rate. Now, granted, tons of loopholes, tons of way to get out of it, but they were paying higher than zero. And he was able to, and thanks to some corporate Democrats, drop that rate all the way down to 28%. And then you go, gee, how did we start down this path to being massively in debt? How did we start running all this up? Well, we created a billionaire class. The people who had the resources to be able to pay for the things that we need, roads, bridges, a massive military. Well, we gave that money away. And then we whipped out the credit card. And we started putting it on debt. As we're in past generations, you know what? We taxed the wealthy. We still had our wars. We still blew things up. But we paid for it. And now they tell us, sorry, we can't. You can't have health care. You can't have education for your children. You can't do this. You can't do that because we don't have the resources. Why? Because we gave it away. We created, again, the largest billionaire class. And not just one billion or two. I think you need like 2.5 now to get on the Forbes 400. It's no more just, hey, I made it a buck over a billion, I'm on the list. No. And to be in the top 10, you're in double-digit billions. There's a problem with our tax code. There's a problem with where we are. It's that simple. But I want to thank everybody today for tuning in. I want to thank our guests. If you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go, wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Make sure you follow us on social media, @RickSmithShow on Twitter, also on Facebook, YouTube. Subscribe, like, share, all that stuff. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1931. That was the day that protesters staged a hunger march on Washington, D.C. 1,600 protesters took part in the march. Communist organizers helped to organize the protest. One of the demands of the march was unemployment insurance for workers who had lost their jobs. The country was in the throes of the Great Depression, caused by the stock market crash of 1929. Far too many people had seen their entire life savings
wiped out by the crash and subsequent bank failures. Millions were out of work and families were losing their homes. There was a growing anger in the country over what was perceived as President Herbert Hoover's indifference and ineffectual dealing with the crisis. The media focused on the communist ties to the D.C. Hunger March. But the idea of the March on Washington grew. The next year, a Pittsburgh priest led an army of 12,000 jobless men to the Capitol to demand unemployment legislation. Then that May, a former cannery worker named Walter B. Walters organized World War I veterans to protest in D.C. They called themselves the Bonus Expeditionary Forces. They demanded early payment of a bonus that Congress had promised them for their service in World War I. The movement of working people grew as a weary and hungry nation demanded action from its elected leaders. As a result, Americans voted President Hoover out of office in the 1932 election. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected on a platform that the U.S. government should act to address the dire conditions of the millions of unemployed. Finally, in August 1935, President Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. This act contained a provision for unemployment insurance. It was a major step towards establishing unemployment protections for workers in the United States.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.